Hello everyone, welcome along. Alice Worsley with you on Wednesday afternoon here at Planet FM, and highly excited I am too because I'm getting a chance to talk to one of my favourite people on television at the moment, and I'm sure a lot of you over the last, 12, 13 weeks or so have been watching a programme on Sunday night called Off the Radar, where Te Radar goes and does a bit of sustainable living out in the west of Auckland, and does it very well, I might add. Well, since the TV series was filmed, he's been busy writing a book about it, hence the reason we've got Te Radar on the program with us today. A very good afternoon to you, fellow Westie.
Yes, and what a good afternoon it is. The sun's shining, it's burnt that cloud off.
It's good to see, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's good.
I've actually hunkered down inside because it's too hot outside.
Well, listen, I wanted, first of all, for my audience, just to establish your name because, I mean, I've always known you as Radar, and then it became Te Radar.
Yeah.
But you actually, your parents didn't, when you were born, go, gosh, he looks like a Radar.
No, they did not.
What did they call you?
No, they called me Andrew. Yes. But that was in the 1971, and Andrew was quite a popular name.
Yes.
And in fact, there was another child at my primary school who had exactly the same name. There were two Andrew Lumstons, which was kind of confusing. And then within my peer group, there were several Andrews, and particularly when I went to university, there was probably about six Andrews in that kind of group of people who'd all been born in the early 70s. So pretty much everyone had a nickname, and Radar came from university. And then when I was on tour with Mike King, it must have been about 7 or 8 years ago.
Yeah.
I was kind of opening for Mike, and I had a mihi. I was performing a mihi at the start of the show, a kind of a comic greeting, and we kind of put the tear onto the front because it just stands for that, really, the Radar, and it stuck.
And do you find that people call you Te Radar now rather than just Radar?
It varies a lot. Some people just call me Radar. Some people call me Te Radar. And people, particularly Marty, just call me Te.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. So maybe I'll be like Prince. I'll drop Radar off the end in another couple of years and I'll just be the.
What a way to go. That'll be good. We'll love that. Can't wait for the album when it comes out, too.
Oh, yeah. Like Paul Holmes.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Now, that was one we definitely will treasure.
Yeah.
Now, listen, tell me a bit about you, too. I mean, you mentioned you went to university. You did the satire. You did the stand-up comedy.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also done quite a bit with documentaries before, because I remember seeing you on a couple of things, including Intrepid Journeys, wasn't it, that you went? Now, where did you go for your
Intrepid? I went to Mali in Africa, North Africa, to Timbuktu. Yeah.
That would have been pretty tough, I would imagine, that one, was it?
No, I don't think it was, actually, because I had the choice of a couple, because I think I could have gone to Borneo, and which I would have loved to have done, and seen the orangutans, but I've never been a big fan of the jungle.
No.
Leeches and snakes and bugs and hiking. So, no, I found the African one quite simple. There was no big treks. There was no big climbs up mountains. There was no kind of worrying about leeches and bugs and things sneaking into my sleeping bag at night. So I found it a bit of a doddle, actually.
How do people react to someone like you with your lovely coloured hair and your pale skin and your glasses? Because, I mean, you would have stood out like the proverbial in Mali.
Yeah, well, I mean, they do get a lot of tourists through. It's quite the tourist trail. So, I think they're used to tourists. So whether I was kind of fair, probably they paid a lot more interest to us because obviously we had a camera crew with us.
And,
you know, cameras do tend to attract attention. So, yeah, it was one of the kind of odd things, actually, that you go to this one of the most remotest places on Earth, this fabled place that for, you know, centuries was renowned not to actually exist, and there they are, so used to tourists. It's quite strange.
Quite incredible, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So how then did the opportunity for you to come about for you to do Off the Radar? Because this was something that at least you could be home for, but you had to basically be dedicated to it for, what was it, nearly 8 months?
Yeah, eight months it was, I think, yeah. So, well, the people who make Off the Radar are the same, Mel Rakener and Jane Andrews. They also make Intrepid Journeys.
Yeah.
They made Marcus's Off the Rails program and Ice. And initially it was, I think, supposed to be Marcus doing the program, but he's got a radio show and couldn't be released. And so they thought, oh, no, who else can we find that's going to go and live in a paddock? And it was quite short notice. I think they approached me in about August, I think, and they wanted to start filming on the the 1st of September, because that was spring.
Yes.
And also, ironically, happened to be my birthday, so like a new beginning. And so they took me out to a lovely lunch, and we had a couple of glasses of Astrolabe Chardonnay, and after two or three glasses of those and the herb encrusted chicken, they said, so, how would you like to go and live in a paddock for 10 months? And I thought, well, what could possibly go wrong? And so that's essentially how quickly it happened, and the deal was done within about a day, and I was busy packing my things up, and off we toddled.
Did you do much prep, though,
no.
Beforehand? You didn't. You literally went in quite green, so to speak.
Yeah, well, I didn't think it was going to be too difficult.
Because
well,
you grew up...
I didn't even have a Yates gardening guide.
Oh, you didn't. And you'd grown up on a farm, too, so you probably thought you'd be able to do it with your hands tied behind
yeah,
your back.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up on a dairy farm, and I'd you know, up until about the age of 18, or probably even as I went through university, going back and school holidays to help out. So I had a lot of dairy farm experience, which I think, you know, it was invaluable for all those little things, water pipes bursting, water troughs breaking down, fencing, being able to use wire and dig holes properly, because digging holes is actually quite an art, you know, putting posts in, and all of that side of things, I was quite kind of confident with, but I'd never shorn a sheep, I don't think I'd had a garden since I was about maybe six, when we had a bit of a garden for, you know, a school garden competition. My mother had always had a big vegetable garden, but I'd never really paid a lot of, attention to it. So, yeah, I think in many ways, if I was to do it again, I'd do a little bit more reading up on
before you started out. But in some respects, that's what made it really interesting, was the fact that you had quite a few crop failures amongst your successes.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's not like an ordinary TV show where they plant something and you come back a month later and there they are eating a bountiful harvest.
Exactly. So you really did have to sort of eat things warts and all at times, didn't you?
Yeah, there was a lot of... Yeah, I got pretty sick of silver beet.
Yeah.
There's only really two things to do with silver beet, and that's eat it raw or cook it.
Or
feed
it to the chooks. Now, my chooks love silver beet.
Must have lovely yellow yolked eggs.
I do. Yeah. I do. And my lovely girls, no, they just adore it, and they're almost addicted to it. They'll sort of follow you around and jump in the air trying to get it. They love it so much.
And it's so funny, you know. That was one of the real highlights of the experience, you know, just being able to sit there and watch chickens do their thing. I'd never had chickens before, and gosh, they're so funny.
They're hilarious. And you got them from a lady called Marjorie who would have been the same as me. I would have lent them to you on the proviso you didn't eat them.
Yes.
And I hope you didn't.
No, didn't eat them. No, they weren't. They certainly weren't eaten. No, those three weren't. there were some others that were, but not those three. They were the kind of the sacred ladies of the show.
And did they provide you with many wonderful golden yolked eggs over the time or not?
When I could figure out where they were laying them. There was no end of searching high and low, and one of them was a wonderful mother, the little kind of pheasanty coloured one. She'd go off and you wouldn't be able to find where she was laying, and then you'd find her sitting on a crop of eggs, and she would hatch those out, and chickens would abound for a while, and then they would grow up, and then they'd start. Well, I don't think some of them didn't quite get old enough to lay eggs, but they are certainly laying now.
Yeah. So when you went out there, I mean, you literally had to clear a space for yourself, didn't you, in a paddock?
Yeah, I had my weed whacker. Weed whacker space,
And then put your tent up, and that was a bit of an old tent too, from what I remember, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a tent that my father had picked up when we went to the Scout Jamboree in Fielding, and I think it must have been about 1984, sometime around then. And I think he'd paid a couple of $100 for it. And we'd had it up, you know, from time to time as a family tent. We never really went camping because, you know, growing up on a dairy farm, you don't really go away in summer. You stay home and milk the cows. And so, I'd borrowed it off him and put it up. And I think it's got some kind of painted on stuff on the inside, you know, with the stencils that talk, the Defence Mortgage Fund 1970. So I suspect that it's probably actually slightly older than me, that tent.
I bet.
Yeah, and thankfully it didn't get too damaged. You know, it was up for a while. It got faded a little bit because it was up for, you know, a couple of months, but it certainly did the job. Wonderful tent.
Yeah.
Really, really great.
And you obviously were in it before it got too hot, because tents in summer, especially old tents like that are really heavy and don't breathe very well, are really hot and...
They do get a bit muddy.
...manky to be in, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. This one is a good one because you can roll the sides up.
Yes.
So you know, you could actually have, all the sides rolled up. But then, of course, as soon as the breeze comes, all your bits of paper and everything blow away. But it is a lovely shady spot in the summertime. But no, then I moved into the caravan that was... in many ways less weatherproof than the tent. It leaked, and you know, got, if a tent gets hot in summer, a caravan gets even hotter. So,
you were there for the whole. So you went from spring, September 1st. You went all through the summer.
Yeah, well, I think we got out to the farm about the end of September, the beginning of October, and I was there through until the end of May.
Okay, so you started to get when it was just starting to get cold, so it was probably quite a nice time to walk away from that, because I would imagine winter would have been a little bit more of a trial for you than actually going through the summer months.
Yeah, winter was would have been horrific, and it had started to get cold, and that was when it kind of got a little bit lonely, actually. The only times I kind of thought, oh, God, you know, you're 2 or 3 weeks away from finishing, it's too late to start planting anything else or to start any big projects, and you know, that's when you kind of think, oh, you know, and then the winter came, and it got really wet. Jane had some cattle running on the rest of the farm that we weren't using for filming, and the whole place just essentially turned into a mud bath. You know, she was disappearing up to her knees in the mud when she went to go and feed out, and so I think, you know, winter is a terrible time for anything, but when you've got camera gear and all of that kind of thing, and you're trying to film things in the rain, it can be very problematic. So,
did they
I would have survived.
Yes, I'm sure. Did they leave you, the camera crew, I mean, did they leave you once they'd finished filming and you were there on your own, or did they stay sort of elsewhere on the
They'd all drive away at night, and I'd be left there on my own to heat my bath and cook my dinner and, you know, do all those kind of things and wash me clothes.
You're briefed.
Yeah, and then they would turn up, and they could be away for, you know, sometimes depending on the nature of what it was we were doing. Sometimes we shot in blocks where we'd shoot kind of, you know, 5 or 10 days in a row. Sometimes, you know, as things got a little bit more spread out, there'd be a couple of days here and a couple of days there. So I would be there quite often with no crew there. In the last kind of few months, there was an edit, you know, we were editing at the farm as well. There was a farmhouse that had the edit suite set up, and so they could come and edit out there, which was really great, because if there's something you kind of missed, or you think, you know, we need another couple of things to complete this sequence, you could go out and pick those off, or if something happened, there was generally someone there who could grab a camera and film it. So it was it was really great. And, you know, I think, you know, kind of even just a community amongst the people there, there was, you know, there's always production assistants and editors and camera people and sound people, so it's quite a wonderful way to spend a few months, actually.
And you got to know the locals quite well too, and I noticed they kind of had you assessed a few times by the way they treated you.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't treat you with kid gloves and like a celebrity. You had to be one of them, really, and get on with it, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing, you know, and I'm really good friends with a lot of the people from the show, you know, I still go out and see them, so as much as, you know, I think there is that kind of relationship that develops, it's always a bit strange when you've got a production crew who ring you up and say, oh, we'd like you to come and do this, and you know, so by the time we've met them and, you know, you go around and see them without the crew there to you know, keep on doing whatever it was that you were doing, or to do some stuff, or they'd invite you around for a drink or something like that, and you become friends, and you do develop a wonderful sense of community, quite different, I think, from other shows where you really are just turning up with the crew and you never see them outside of that situation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've got friends out there who I continually go and see, and they really made it, actually. That, you know, they made me very welcome and certainly added a lot to the show.
What do you think it gave to you as a person, actually having that experience? It must have... Did it change you in some ways? I'm not trying to be all touchy-feely
and it's a question that a lot of people ask, and I've been trying to figure out, and I think it probably did in subtle ways that I probably don't really notice myself. I was out yesterday, we had a golf day, a charity golf day in honour of Kevin Smith, who passed away a few years ago, and Ewan Gilmore was there, and we had a barbecue at the end, and he'd gotten a couple of bits of steak, and there was some left, and he had a half a bit left, and I said, oh, are you going to eat that? And he said, no, and I went to take it, and someone said, oh, do you think you're taking that because of, you know, you've learned this from the show? And I kind of thought, no, don't know, probably just a bit too lazy to walk to the buffet. So, yeah, and, you know, I think probably it has... certainly made me more aware of the simplicity of some of the things. You know, it's not difficult to really to grow things once you can figure out how to do it. It's one of the easiest things there is to do in some cases, until, of course, things go wrong. And I think and it gave me a new appreciation, I think, for that rural lifestyle and the fact that we're a very privileged country in that respect. You know, one of the German guys, Walter, who helped put the the solar system, and, you know, he was watching some of the footage. We'd gone, I think, goat shooting or something like that. And he said, you know, in Europe, we could never do that. We could, you'd have to get permission from a landowner, and you'd have to go, you know, there's a huge rigmarole and licenses. And, you know, here in New Zealand, we almost take that for granted. If you know someone who's got goats or pigs or, you know, everyone, well, not everyone, but, you know, a lot of people go deer hunting, and, you know, pretty much everyone's had a fishing experience of one kind or another. So, you know, I think we do take that for granted, and it's good to be reminded of the fact that, you know, that's not something that everyone has.
Mm. What was the hardest thing you had to do? Because I know one I watched, and I must admit I had to turn away, was when your poor old cattle, your cow got that, what would you call it,
facial
eczema. What were the, or one of the hardest things that you had to do? Was it to see some of your animals put down, or...?
Yeah, probably that one, because it was a kind of a needless, well, not a needless death, but, you know, there was no... It wasn't as if you'd grown that cow up and then you were, you know, shooting it so that you could, you know, feed a whole lot of people. Mm. It was just kind of a wasted, terrible life in many ways. So that was quite difficult. And it is always difficult to kind of, you know, to harvest animals. I don't think it's not something that I do willy nilly. And, you know, and you do think about it a bit, but then again, you know, I think as I said in the show, you give them the best life that they can, and then you make sure that their death is as quick and as humane as possible, and you make sure that you use all of it. I think that's something I became, you know, really conscious of. You don't want to throw anything away, because it's quite valuable like that. But yeah, you know, I was talking with someone this morning, and you had a mob of goats, and I needed to shoot a couple of goats for some meat and to make salami and stuff. And he said, well, which one am I going to shoot? You know, I've kind of got this hand of God. I'm going to reach in and take a couple of those goats from their wonderful wandering around the pasture. Mm. And it's quite a weird thing, really. And it does make you kind of think about that. But then you kind of go ahead and you do it nonetheless. And as I say, you try to make sure that it's not just for fun.
No, exactly. Yeah. And then there was eating eel, which of course was a more than unpleasant experience for you.
Well, I did it a few times. You know, I don't really like eels at the best of times. They're slithery and quite horrible and relatively unpleasant. And the first time was one of those funny ones where, you know, the unreality of having the reality TV crew was there. You know, by the time we got the eels, it was getting dark and there was nearly time for the crew to knock off, otherwise they'd go into overtime. So we had to cook it relatively quickly, and I just kind of took the eel, and instead of filleting it nicely and pan frying it or something, I kind of cut it into big, like, tuna steaks and threw it in a pan, and it was like eating vaguely fish tasting rubber. It wasn't very pleasant at all. I mean, it was okay. I really enjoyed it. Don't get me wrong, I did not enjoy it, but I just don't think it was the best way to cook eel. And then, you know, the next time I cooked them, I put it in a little smoker, and it was absolutely delicious.
Completely. So what was the most delicious thing that you did eat then? I mean, was it the turkey for Christmas or the pig? Or?
Look, there was probably about two or three things. I would say the first of the chickens one of the roosters that I grew and I cooked in the mud oven, because I love chicken, and I really love that kind of gamey, organic chicken kind of thing. So that was really delicious. One of the pork roasts from Little Willie or JT, whichever one of the roasts that got cooked up in the mud oven. And probably actually one of the duck that I had gotten duck shooting season. Again, another little treat from the mud oven. Yes. Which I think my mother is getting on to me and hassling me about that now. I saw her the other day. She goes, oh, you better be jolly well coming down to build me one of those.
Were they proud of what you did? I mean, because they must have watched you on TV and on the whole, I would imagine, being very proud of their son, Andrew Lumsden.
Yes, I think they probably were. We had them up there for Christmas Day and they had a good look around. And and I know that from the comments I've had, you know, they were saying, oh, we've got people stopping us in the supermarket and Huntley. They're going, oh, is that your son on the television? Oh, we watch it every week. And I think, I don't know whether they quite expected that, you know, and I'm sure that they were worried, you know, as anyone is, you know, if the show's not going to succeed, you know, 13 weeks at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night is a long time, and it's that ignominious kind of pulling something off halfway through the season if it doesn't rate. But, you know, thankfully it did rate really well, and I think they're chuffed.
And it did rate incredibly well, and you were telling me off air too that it was so popular with children.
Yeah, not something I would ever have expected. You know, it was up against The Zoo, which is a program with lovely, fluffy animals, none of which are killed and eaten. And, you know, I had a lot of emails from people, even from the very first a few episodes where they said, oh, my children love it. And people I'd bump into say, oh, you know, particularly 4 and 5, 6, 7 year olds, they're saying that it had that nag factor. When's Off the Radar going to be on? And, you know, and emails from people saying that their kids were inconsolable when the series finished. And I find that very strange because I didn't think it would be the kind of program that children would be kind of hooked on, but I guess it had it all, you know, and probably lots of fun things for them to do, you know. They can build a worm farm and they can plant some vegetables, and maybe the, you know, folks might let them get some chickens or something like that. So it's, yeah, they could do that, and then, you know, everyone loves seeing animals and all the kind of the great characters and building stuff. So I think it had a little bit of something for everyone, really.
And also maybe there's a sort of a deep inner subconscious longing in children for the kind of childhoods you had and I had.
Yeah.
Where part of it, like for me, was my grandparents' farm.
Yeah.
And you did get in touch with farm, and you saw where animals came from, and you saw how food was grown, whereas today's kids lack a lot of that, don't they?
Yeah, there's a real a distance from that. And as far as they know, you know, it's not even as if we go to the butcher now and you see the carcasses hung up, you know, as they sort of are. You know, now it all comes in polystyrene little things in the supermarket, and nothing looks like it does. The only thing that's going to remotely look like what it used to look like is maybe, you know, perhaps a chicken, you know, a whole chicken, or certainly a fish, but that's really about it. Everything else is chopped up. But, you know, traveling around the world, that's not the case. You go to some place. I remember in Africa when we're, you know, on the Intrepid journey, and you were ordering a bit of, you know, a bit of meat from the sheep standing there, literally, you know, a little mob of them standing there tied up to a pole, and then whenever, you know, because it's so hot, there's no refrigeration, and whenever they run out, they kill another one, and then it's cooked up right there in front of you, and so you can stand there, and the whole process is happening within the space of 2 meters.
Yeah.
You know, can you imagine that happening here?
Oh, goodness me.
It just would never happen.
No.
So, you know, there is, we don't have that, and I think there is, you know, that sense of, that when you think back about it, everyone who's got that kind of uncle and auntie's farm or grandparents' farm or something like that, and they're wonderful days out there running around in the countryside and dogs and sheep and cows. Yeah, they were magic times.
Indeed. Well, I think your program helped bring some magic to kids' lives. And I love the end of your book, which, of course, is written about the series. It's called Off the Radar, A Man, A Plan and a Paddock.
Yes.
And you say at the end, I've come full turkey circle. I'm sustainable, sort of. Now, get growing, New Zealand. No, really, get growing. And do you think that that is something that Kiwis are doing more? Because I heard recently that plant centres and that, the amount of vegetable seedlings and seeds they're selling now is phenomenal.
Yes, such, even right back through till kind of the winter months there when people were putting on the citrus. You know, I had a friend, my neighbour actually went to King's Plant Barn, I think, the other day, and they were out of vegetable seedlings.
Good.
They just couldn't get enough. And I think people really are doing it. And in that way, the show was perfectly timed to hit. You know, we had that terrible winter, and broccoli went up to $7 a kilo, and $7, you know, a head sort of thing, and vegetables were horrendously expensive. And yeah, so I think it's part of that, and part of it's people just realizing that maybe it's not that difficult, you know, to get out there and do that and plant some stuff. Just, you know, with the recession to save, having to go to the supermarket and buy lettuce and buy tomatoes and buy herbs, you know, you can do it yourself. And it's much, much cheaper. So, I think people are really doing it. And what will be interesting, I think, Alice, will be to see whether they continue to do it.
Yes.
You know, whether they get hooked on it.
Yeah.
And I always say to people, you know, do it with, get your kids out there. You know, that whole push-play thing. You don't have to take your kids to the park to share an experience and get some exercise. Get them out into the garden, and then they've got something invested in it, and their enthusiasm will drive your enthusiasm, and when the kids get a bit sick of it, then you can give them a bit of a G-up, and when you get a bit of a sick of it, they'll give you a bit of a G-up, and at the end of it, you've got something to eat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And what was the most tastiest thing from your garden? I mean, to me, I love tomatoes at the top of the season garden. They're great, aren't
and
they?
And they started growing wild.
Did they?
I had some compost there that from the farm that had, you know, been there before, and it must have had tomato seeds in it. And they just popped up. The tomatoes, the beetroot. I did my mother's beetroot recipe, bottled beetroot.
Yes.
Just superb. What else was it? I think there was a kale or something like that. Some kind of plant that I could never figure out how to cook it properly. It was always a bit weird. And then as we got near the end, I realized I was eating the wrong part of the plant. You were supposed to eat the root, but I was eating the leaves. I'm sure this is some kind of stir-fried greed. But, you know, it must have been good for me. I didn't get scurvy.
No.
So,
and did you get sick while you were doing that?
I got sick on the last, almost the very, very last day. There was a bug going around the district, and I'd been to someone's house and their children and had come down with it and my friend had come down with it very badly, and I must have just got the tail end of that, and it really knocked me for six. But other than that, no, not sick at all, not from the show, just basically from children.
Beware. Yeah. Hey, so listen, will you do anything like this again? Have you got other plans coming up?
No, not so much this. You know, we did discuss whether or not we would do it again somewhere, and the question was, you know, would you do it in the same place and use the same kind of group of people and improve on that, or would you go to another part of the country? And as soon as you go to another part of the country, then the costs become quite prohibitive, because, you know, the budgets aren't that big for that kind of thing, and, you know, New Zealand on their money, they don't want to kind of throw it away liberally. So, yeah, there is a question. There was a question of maybe would you come back and do a series in the city where you were doing that, but at the end I think we were all a little bit kind of, you know, we'd had 10 full months of doing it and there was a bit of other stuff going on, so, you know, then we kind of missed the season. But, you know, never know. If someone would say, hey, maybe we'll do something like that again, then yeah, absolutely.
Well,
it was, you know, it's basically a wonderful way to kind of spend several months, actually.
And incredible, too, because your public profile, whether you like it or not, has increased, you know, a millionfold, hasn't it,
by
being on television.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And may I say, you write really well, too.
Oh,
and
thank you.
This is going to be the kind of book that people will love to get, especially over the Christmas period, you know, sit down on a summer's day under a tree, you know, with a nice glass of beer or whatever, and read your book and just have a few chuckles, but also learn a lot, too, as they read your book.
Yeah, you know, and I kind of consciously wrote it that you can read it right through from beginning to end as a narrative, or I like to call it a toilet book. You can sit and you can read a chapter here and there.
Yeah.
You know, those are the writers I love, where you can read the whole thing and it's funny, and then you go back to your favourite chapter every now and then, and you kind of deal with that, and you can pick and grab at it.
No, well, it's fantastic. It's called Off the Radar, A Man, a Plan and a Paddock by T. Radar. And, of course, it's based on the TV series. It's published by HarperCollins. It's out there in all good bookstores now, and it's only $29.99, so it's under $30.
It is.
Makes it a great Christmas gift.
It does. You know, and the great thing is, if you do read it and you don't like it, it makes good mulch.
and
if anyone you know out there is listening, I'm doing a kind of a show tomorrow night at the Classic. It's an hour long kind of show based on the book and based on the TV series, so people can come along to that in Queen Street and hear, you know, similar and probably mostly different things from what we've discussed, because I've yet to actually sit down and figure out what I'm saying.
Good. Well, I may have got some of your repertoire sorted for
you
today.
You may well have done. I'll send you a commission.
Good on you, mate.
Thanks, Alice.
Hey,
thank
lovely
you.
To talk to you, Ted Radar. All the best and have a happy Christmas.
You too. Merry Christmas.
All the best. Bye-bye. There's Ted Radar, and the book is called Off the Radar, A Man, a Plan and a Paddock. And I tell you what, it is fantastic reading. You will love it. And as I say, it's available in all good bookstores right now.